I'm Juliana Grassi, your host of the Rare Disease Report podcast. In the U.S., a rare disease is classified as having fewer than 200,000 documented cases per year. However, rare disease may be more prevalent than you think. Approximately 25 to 30 million Americans, or 1 in 10 people, are living with one of the 7,000 rare diseases that span a multitude of medical specialties. Less than 10% of them have an FDA-approved treatment. There's no shortage of challenges in the rare disease space. Individuals with these conditions may have limited to no treatment options. Researching therapies can be difficult or virtually impossible due to the lack of funding or access to patients. Many of these challenges constitute a lack of awareness on the part of the medical community, patients, government agencies, and the general public. So let's start talking. In the second part of our CDKL5 deficiency disorder feature, Dr. Pestana Knight joins me to share her expertise in treating patients with CDD. As a pediatric epileptologist at the Epilepsy Center of the Cleveland Clinic Neurological Institute. Can you give us some background on the rare CDKL5 deficiency and how it presents in patients?
So CDKL5 deficiency disorder, or CDD, how we most of the time call it, is a very refractory form of developmental and epileptic encephalopathy. It's one of the diseases that have been relatively recently diagnosed, since we didn't know about their existence before 2003. But it quickly has claim their place in the epilepsy care because of the characteristics of the disease at the time of presentation. The most common symptom at the time of presentation is refractory seizures. The seizures typically present in the first 2 months of life, and at the beginning, the seizures could be focal motor or focal with automatisms, or they could be truly generalized. There is not a specific pattern at onset, but by the time that the patients arrive to the epilepsy centers, many of them already are failing 3 or 4 medications, and I am talking as early as age 4 months.
Wow.
So seizure is a number one hallmark of the disease. Other elements of the disease include developmental delay, lack of developmental progression. Many of our patients do not achieve walking, and a great majority, they don't develop language. They can have movement disorder that can present earlier life or fluctuate throughout their life as they get older. The muscle tone is typically low, and as they age also, they can develop scoliosis, or they can develop spasticity, and specifically they can develop dystonia as the disease progresses and these patients get older. Many of them have swallow difficulties that lead to the establishment of an enteral route to guarantee nutrition. And this is not just a disease that affects the brain. The gastrointestinal symptoms are very common. We can see the patient has reflux, they have repetitive vomiting, constipation is a big problem. They can have respiratory symptoms, including irregular breathing. They can have recurrent infections. With the development of dystonia, they can develop joint contractions and deformities. I already mentioned the scoliosis. Many of our children, they have growth retardation. They have no weight for their age. So it's a disease that it doesn't affect only the brain or have brain manifestations. So for the care of this patient, it's very important to have a team that works together of specialists in coordination with the pediatrician and the families. And of course, therapies are paramount for the treatment of these patients. There is another symptom that I forgot to mention within the neurological symptom, and it's the insomnia. Oftentimes, the patients can have difficulty falling asleep. I think that the disease is distinctive enough that by now the International League Task Force of Epilepsy Definition has added CDKL5 deficiency disorder as an etiology-specific syndrome that presents during the infancy period. So this is the degree of recognition that we have in our community for this disease, and therefore it's very important to educate our physicians and healthcare providers.
Thank you. And I know you mentioned that the disease was only even recognized not too long ago. So how much is currently understood about the disease, and do you know much about how it was discovered?
So it's an interesting disease because at the beginning, because a number of manifestations that the patient had, the inability to develop language, the cortical visual impairment, which is another symptom that we see and I didn't mention before. Some patients have a stereotypical behavior that is not specifically the hand wringing, but that we see in Rett disease, but they may have leg crossings and some repetitive behavior. So these patients initially were lumped together with the Rett syndrome. Now, once the Rett syndrome gene, the MECP2 gene, was discovered, we learned that these patients were negative for a MECP2 gene. So they received the label of Rett negative disease. Mm-hmm. And then it was when we learned that in these patients that were Rett negative, in reality, they have a mutation in the cyclin-dependent kinase LIFE5 gene, which is a gene that is located in the X chromosome. And this means that they're going to be mostly girls affected, but also there are males that can suffer the disease. Mm-hmm. One interesting thing is that in some males, they can present with a very severe form of the disease, but some of them, particularly they are mosaic, they can have a milder form, but they can also be affected with refractory seizures, which is the hallmark symptom for the majority of these patients.
Wow, thank you. And can you elaborate a little bit on how this disease relates to epilepsy?
So the seizure is the number one manifestation at the onset of the disease. And as I mentioned before, the seizures are very refractory to treatment. By the time that the patients arrive to the center of excellence, oftentimes they are on two or three medications. And also, the seizures change the way that they look. At the beginning, they may have focal motor seizures, and then quickly they start having what we call now sequential seizures, which is a mixture of seizures in which a common phenomenon is that they have a stiffening of tonic component, and this can be followed by a sequence of spasms. Some patients develop a type of seizure that has got the attention of the epileptologist, which is the hypermotor tonic spasm sequence, or HTSS seizure type, in which the patient initially has a phase in which there are rapid disorganized movements, and this is followed by a stiffening, and then we see the sequence of spasms. These seizures they typically are not present at the very beginning of the disease, but you can see them typically after 6-7 months of age. And it's not the only seizure type. These patients have other seizure types. So that's how this disease relates to epilepsy. That's also why the International League Against Epilepsy has made a special definition of etiology-specific epilepsy type, which is the CDKL5 deficiency disorder.
So would those seizures be a distinguishing factor when trying to differentiate between typical epilepsy and this CDKL5 deficiency?
I think that the more we learn about the variety of genetic diseases that present early in life, the more confident we will be able to separate them apart, okay? Mm-hmm. Nevertheless, I have to highlight the importance of genetic testing in any child that has early onset disease. Because as I mentioned, the patient can present with focal motor disease, right? Mm-hmm. And when we, as epileptologists, see an infant that is having focal motor diseases, we are too thinking about malformation. We are not necessarily thinking that we are facing a patient who has a genetic condition. Yet, that could be the case, that we are seeing a patient that has a genetic condition. So I think that the algorithm for any child that presents in a developed country with an early onset epilepsy in the first 6 months of life should include the MRI looking for lesion, but also it should include genetic testing because the epilepsy may look focal, but may not be due mm-hmm. to a focal lesion. It may be a genetic epilepsy.
Okay. And in terms of genetic therapies and research in that field, is there anything currently going on for this specific deficiency?
Well, you know, the genetic editing and genetic therapy era has arrived to neurology. There are a number of conditions that are treated with significant improvement on the quality of life of the patient with genetic therapies. This is what we wish for a patient who has CDKL5 deficiency disorder. And there have been some efforts in that direction with animal studies that have documented that if you treat this patient, these animals, with gene therapies, we can get a stall of the symptoms and even a reversal of some of the symptoms. But I think that we are not yet at the point that we can apply this to human research, but hopefully soon, because there are many groups working behind the scene to make this happen. Certainly, we hope that this will be a game changing for this disease, and that therapies will accomplish better seizure control, but also something that is very important for the parents and caregivers, which is gain in development, right? Mm-hmm. Improvement of their development is an important goal that we need to accomplish when we look at the treatment for these patients.
Certainly. And along those lines, in terms of treatments or therapies for this rare disorder, have there been any FDA-approved medications? And if so, how have they impacted the management of this disease and the field in general?
So the FDA recently approved ganaxolone or Sutomi for the treatment of seizures related to CDKL5 deficiency disorder. This approval followed a clinical trial, and it was the first randomized clinical trial that was done in patients with CDKL5 deficiency disorder. And that trial documented that patients who received, it was a placebo-controlled trial, and the patients who received ganaxolone have a median percent of seizure reduction of around 30% compared to the patients that received placebo. And that trial also documented that the medication is very well tolerated. There were no deaths. The main side effects were somnolence, increase in seizures, or fever. And there were no deaths in the trial. So this is definitely a game-changing medication because it has been studied on the disease, right? We are talking about a population in which the traditional anti-seizure medication, they have a very poor response. There is data documented that these patients at 3 months They have a response rate that is very low in the 20% to anti-seizure medication. And once you hit the GR mark, the response is even lower. Even if you were able to control temporarily the seizures relax with vengeance after a while. So there was not a good, adequate anti-seizure medication out there. So now we have ganaxolone. So hopefully the medication will come to the market soon, and we will be able to treat many more patients with this medication.
Okay. So it is, it's been approved, but it's not yet on the market.
It hasn't come out to the market yet. Still, the patients are receiving medication via the open label trial or the expanded access program.
Okay, thank you. And is there anything else that you wanted to discuss about this that we haven't touched on already?
So you mentioned earlier that we are talking about this disease that is young disease, relatively young disease, compared to other diseases that we have in neurology that cause epilepsy, such as tuberous sclerosis, which have been known since the 1800s. And I think that it is remarkable to know how much we have learned in such a relatively period of time. And this has been possible because the parents got organized via the International Foundation for CDKL5 Research. And they were pivotal on saying to the physicians and researchers, we need help to understand the disease of our children so we can make them better. So I think that what we have accomplished is because of their dedication and their care and their desire to see their children developing better and living a life where seizures are better controlled. This is one important aspect. For any young disease, we are still in the process of learning. And one of the things that we are engaged now is to try to develop tools that can be applied to future clinical trials where instead of just counting the number of seizures, we can account and see how the patients are developing and is the medication that, and treatments that we are bringing to treat the disease are also impacting other areas of the diseases of this disease that hasn't been measured before. So this is what we are working hard now with the families, try to develop this disease-specific tool. And there have been some data already explaining the process of how we develop the tools in collaboration again between the clinicians and the parents, and looking at what are the items that are more important and really will be measurable as time goes by and once a new medication becomes available.
Thank you, Dr. Pestana Knight, for sharing your expert insight on CDD. If you haven't already listened to the first episode of this CDKL5 Deficiency Disorder feature, I speak with Whitney Mitchell, who shares her experience in being a caregiver and mother to her daughter Havila, who was diagnosed with a rare disease. Be sure to subscribe to the podcast or follow us on social media so you don't miss our next episode. Once again, I'm your host, Juliana Grassi, and thank you so much for listening to the Rare Disease Report.